Access number 29536, Mr. Bert Scrivens, Reel 1. Could you tell me when and where you were born, Mr. Scrivens?
I was born in Mitcham, Surrey, in a nursing home. I can't remember the name of it. In 1921, on the 21st of February. At 10:30 in the morning, if you want that detail.
And were your family living in Mitcham?
Yes.
And can you tell us a bit about your family background?
Ah, it gets a little complicated. My father came originally from Birmingham. He was born in the Ladywood area. Can't tell you the year at the moment, but later on I can give you the date. Let me see. He was one of a family of 9 children, and mother and father, of course. I believe his first job at the age of about 12 was as a butcher's apprentice. And his very first job, he told me, was to hold one end of a rope that went through the nose ring of a bull, and another apprentice took the other one, and they had to hold the bull still while the butcher pole-axed it. I gather it was a bit of a shambles, no pun intended, because the other boy let go his end of the rope. There was a bit of mayhem going on then. I don't know much about that. The next job, not too much later, I gather, was for the Lanchester Car Company in Birmingham. Again, as an apprentice, I gather. And his first job was to go down to the police station and get the keys to open up the works by 6 o'clock in the morning. I presume he did the usual jobs that apprentices did in those days. His only claim to fame in that company, as far as I can gather, was there was a rather big car race went on from somewhere down in the West Country to Manchester, I believe, which was quite an undertaking in those days. And every day, of course, the cars stopped and parked somewhere, but eventually the Lanchester car got to Birmingham, to the works, and they immediately went to work to service it. But he was first told to clean it and wash it down, which he did by turning a hose on it. But the problem was that the car specialised in something that, and I don't know what the hell it is, a hot box ignition. Never heard of it before, well, that's what my father said. But of course the hose swamped it and put the car out of action. And as he told me, he said, I literally got my ass kicked out of there. Next time I ever heard of him, or what he told me, he was either in Brooks, the saddle people, as assistant works manager. How he got from one to the other, I'll never know. Not now, anyway. And then he became assistant works manager after that in Nettlefolds, the original screw-making company that later became Geskeen and Nettlefolds. He told me what he assured me was correct, but my reading since leads me to doubt it, that their claim to fame and the basis of their prosperity was that they invented, or discovered, really, I suppose is the right word, the self-tapping screw. Up to that time, all wood screws were blunt-ended, as in bolts and so on. And they were made up, knocked up, the head was knocked up, from drawn wire. Well, when you draw a wire, the end of it always is always left with a taper. And instead of cutting off the taper to do a screw, on a test of a new reel of wire, a foreman actually started cutting the thread on the taper and right the way up, and suddenly saw the possibilities. Instead of having to drill a hole accurately for the length, found that you could actually drive it into the wood. Apparently he took it to his masters, and they patented the whole idea. And screw making, I understand, was a cottage industry in the Birmingham area then. Every little house had its own little lathe and so on, and made screws. Having made that, taken out that worldwide patent, of course, they shut down all the other industries, all the cottage industries, and held the license, of course, for anybody else who wanted to make it. Bang, Geskeen and Nettlefolds. The next thing I heard, he went to London. No, there was a bit in between that. He met a girl and who was suffering, I gather, from TB, and had only a very short time to live. She wanted to get married, so he did. And later on, when she died, he moved to London as a government inspector for Woolwich Arsenal, which was probably 2 years before the First World War. I'm not too sure about that date. Now, this is... oh, yes, I can tell you this. His mother, who had previously died, had a sister who had gone to London and met and married a Frederick Fox, who lived in Wandsworth. So naturally my father went to stay with him. Now, I'll have to digress a bit here. Frederick Fox was the father of my mother. He married twice. She was the only child of the first marriage, and then the second marriage was to Esther Currell, who of course was the aunt of my father, which led me to have a very confused childhood, because what to me was my grandmother was to him his aunt. It took me years and years to sort that one out. But obviously, having stayed with her, that's when he met my mother, because he went to the Woolwich Arsenal to work, which he did apparently right throughout the war. After that, he became technical advisor to various Birmingham metal manufacturing companies until he had, sometime in the 20s, late 20s, I think. Yeah, it would be. The late 20s, he had rheumatic fever, which was the fourth bout he'd had. One as an infant, one as a sub-teenager, one as a young man, and the last one in the 20s. That put him out of work. And it took him apparently a long time to get work again. He had, or between them, of course, they had...
When had they been married?
Hmm?
When were they married?
They were married about 1913, I believe. I can get these dates for you later if I'd known you want them, because I have a family tree. There were four children. Frederick was the oldest boy. Then came Esther, about 2 years later. And about 6 years later came myself. And 4 years after me was my younger brother.
So your family were reasonably well off for the time until your father fell ill when you were a young boy?
Well, yes, I suppose we were. A little, I suppose, above working class, or could you call ourselves upper working class if there's such a thing. We had a car because, as technical advisor, he used to go around to various companies. Later became a commercial traveller, or still known as a technical advisor, and he travelled around the country, one town and district at a time, a week at a time. He used to leave us Monday and be back Friday night, unless, of course, he went to Scotland or Ireland, where he was away for 2 weeks. So we didn't see an awful lot of him.
And what was life like for you as a child, a young child? Any memories?
I used to belong to a little group, gang, whatever, of local boys and girls. Of course, then we could play in the streets. There was practically no traffic, and our road was a dead end as far as traffic was concerned. So we used to have quite a lot of fun. And at that time, electricity was being put into houses. I lived in a terraced house in Liveden Road, which was on the borders of Mitcham. Strictly speaking, our address was Tooting Junction, because we were on the borderline. Across the road was Tooting, and the road behind us was Mitcham. So we called ourselves Tooting Junction, of the Southwest 17 district. Very close to Tooting Railway Station, really. To reach that, we had to go along a footpath over a railway bridge and up to the Mitcham Croydon main road.
And what about your education? Tell us about that.
Education. I went to the usual infant school, of Fortescue Road Infant School. I went to the middle school, junior mixed as we called them in those days. And later, when I was 11, we automatically moved to Singlegate Central School, as it was known then, elementary school, and I stayed there till I was 14.
Now, how did you do at school? What subjects were you good at, bad at, like, dislike?
Well, we were probably the first comprehensive school in the country, almost. We took a quick examination when we first arrived at the school, and we were streamed. Was the commercial type, academically brighter. B was the mechanical manual type of worker, or prospective worker, and the C were those who were probably illiterate, and they took classes in gardening and whatever. That was until we got to the fifth form. And I was streamed A, and because of, I suppose, the pressure of places in the school, inside a year I got to the fifth form. I went in at the third, went to the fourth on the next term, and the term afterwards I was in the fifth form, which was overcrowded. So they had to shift some of us, so we sat an instant examination, and somehow, by the skin of my teeth, I got promoted to the sixth form. Now, sixth form was different. It was split into commercial and technical. Commercial, you took things like double entry bookkeeping, shorthand typing, general algebra, geometry, arithmetic, French, art, woodworking, metalworking. In all, a good round education for starting work as a kid in any commercial enterprise. The technical side did car mechanics, physics, chemistry, lots of woodworking, lots of metalwork, and so on. It was a free choice, and I elected to go commercial, so I followed the usual things through. Trouble was that classwork was sort of repetitive. Each term followed on the next term. And you sort of, by the end of the year, well, if you're in the second year, of course, you started revising again. Which left me at sort of top of the school. I came first in everything because I'd already done it. So I was appointed headmaster's prefect and used to look after the attendance registers. Sort of acted as a school secretary does these days. I didn't do an awful lot of classwork, I must admit. Being a naturally lazy kind of person, I skived off everything I could. And I left work at 14.
Left school?
Left school, I mean.
So,
yeah.
No thought of going on?
No. When I was 10, I sat a examination for secondary school. I was too young, and I hadn't even heard of half the subjects I was sitting for. So I missed out. In any case, had I won, I couldn't have gone because my sister was already at the Wimbledon Commercial School, and that took all the money we had to keep her going there.
So what were you going to do? What work would you take? You'd leave in, what, 1935?
Well, I didn't even know what I wanted. The choice was you worked in the city, or you worked locally, and you found what work there was. As it happened, the school had a very good name, and employers queued up to take boys. The company I eventually worked for was an advertising agency in Fleet Street, John Haddon and Company. Who were fairly prestigious. They had maybe Todd the Swan Pen people, the Imperial Tobacco Company, Players Branch and so on, as clients, Hovis, Allen and Hanbury and so on. Their clients. And they had offices in Salisbury Square, just off Fleet Street.
Now, what were you doing for them?
Well, I started off as a messenger boy, delivering printing blocks, correspondence and so on, as everybody did in those days. They always used boys as messengers, didn't use postlift much, or the telephone if they could help it. And we used to do two rounds a day, two deliveries a day, and collecting what we call voucher copies of whichever newspaper offices we went to. There was a third round first thing in the morning where we went round to the city offices, or London offices, of all the major newspapers and major provincials, and collected free copies for the use of the agency as they were required. I kept on there until I was 15, and at 15 I went indoors into the reception area. And because I had learned to type at school, they put me on to typing circulars more than anything else to send out to clients, especially for a publication where we held all the advertising rights for Baptist Times, I believe it's called, and the Asiatic Review, that was another one. After that, I was about 16, I was 16. They asked me if I wanted to go into the space buying department, what is now known as media executive sort of stuff. But then it was just a lad in the space buying department, buying newspaper space for a certain number of our clients for a campaign in whichever country, part of the country, I should say, was required, and type of the public that we were after. It's a rather complicated process, but that's what I was there to learn, which I did until I was 18.
What about outside of that? Did you have any big hobbies, you know, like Boy Scouts or anything like that?
I belonged to the Boys Brigade from the age of 12 to about 15.
And what sort of activities did you get up to with them?
The main thing was that it was a very military kind of organisation, so I was very good on foot drill, apart from anything else, first aid. And we used to go to camp once a year, to Stubbington, Hampshire, I think. Apart from that, there are all sorts of odds and ends that we did, but mainly it was first aid, foot drill, and so on.
Did you have a uniform?
A pillbox, white, haversack, and a belt. That was it. Unless you became NCO, in which case you've got an armband with your stripe on it.
And you were there till you were 15?
Up to 15, from 12 to 15.
Any other big hobbies or?
Nothing apart from that, no.
Any sport?
No, I wasn't interested in sport at all. When I was 16, group of us at work got permission to use the ladies' restroom, and in the lunch hours we learned to dance ballroom fashion as one did in those days. Everybody danced then. Everybody. And we used to go out in parties and go dancing, mainly around the West End, strangely enough.
Where would you go?
Oh, anywhere where there was looked like an interesting dance or a good band, or whatever. Sometimes you heard of dances that were going to go on, or somebody could get tickets and
would
such.
Would it be at the dance hall, specialist dance halls, or would it be anywhere?
Hotels, dance halls, whatever. In those days, everybody, well, that's an exaggeration, but most people danced. And every little room over the co-op sort of type room had a little combo playing, French chalk on the floor, and you danced. But that included the what would later become known as Teddy Boys, Spivs and whatever, the Hard Boys. They would do that too. And you see them every Friday and Saturday night anyway, going off to the dance with their dance shoes wrapped up in newspaper under their arm and their jug-handled ties and the rest of it. Girls in their comp dresses, as they called them, party dresses with sandals under their arm or in bags or whatever. Nobody in those days, nobody would go onto a dance floor in street shoes. Well, not unless they wanted trouble. Even if it was only a room with French chalk on the floor. It was a very social scene.
Now, what about, were you aware of the situation in Germany, Hitler, things like that?
Oh, yes, yes. I had some grounding in that. The teacher who taught English, French and art, strangely enough, was also fluent, and I mean conversation such fluent, in 15 languages. There were hard days in those days, and to get a teacher like that in an elementary school was really something, but it was not unusual. He also had various dialects and so on, in which he could get by.
Now, what did he tell you?
He was very interested in places like Hungary and so on, had lots of friends over there, and he used to tell us about the Nazis, which didn't mean very much to us when you were 12 and 13 and 14 even. Later on, working in Fleet Street, I became very much aware of them. And, of course, in 1938, we could see trouble was coming one way and another. Even a 17-year-old became aware, no matter what. And...
Tell me how you came to join the Territorial, because that was your response, in a sense, when you became...
My response, then.
What caused you to join the TA?
Well, I quite liked the sound of a military life, because of my brother, of course, who was regular army. And my brother-in-law, sister's husband, he had joined the Royal Corps of Signals as a Territorial. And I thought to myself, riding a motorbike, I'd love to do that. In fact, I did own a motorbike at the age of 17. Terrible old thing, called an Excelsior two-stroke, which was either seizing up or killing everybody with clouds of exhaust smoke. Which I had when I was 17. It cost the enormous sum of £3.10, which is, it should have been on the scrap heap, but it was my pride and joy. And because I was riding a motorbike, I naturally wanted to be a donar. Anyway, I made the mistake of going to the nearest drill hall with the Territorials, which was the headquarters of the 9th Battalion, the Royal Fusiliers, City of London Regiment.
Where was that
at? At Balham High Road.
Did it have a name, or was it just Balham High Road Drill Hall?
Balham High Road Drill Hall, yeah. I went there on my 18th birthday, told them I wanted to be a donar, and they talked me into becoming a member of the Mortar Platoon.
Now, do you remember the interview or the sort of process of joining?
Sort of. They asked me what I wanted to do, and I said I'd like to be a donar. Dispatch rider, that is. They said there were no vacancies. Why didn't I join the mortar platoon? They didn't march. They rode about on a 1,500-weight truck with their mortar, which appealed to me because I never did like walking or marching very much. Not knowing any better, I agreed to it. They then sent me off to a side room where I saw an MO who gave me a quick medical.
Was it a proper medical, or was it just a quick glance?
Well, they tested the heart and lungs and... had a look in various orifices, and interested in the fact that when I was two, I'd had a mastoid operation, and they thought I might be deaf in that ear. I thought I was. But the test for that was to hold a watch to the left ear and the right ear, and then in the centre of my forehead to see where I could hear the watch, which ear I could hear the watch ticking. I took a flyer at it because it didn't make any difference to me, and told them one ear, right, I think it was. And they said, oh, that's all right, you're in. And then we